Welcome back to the Bitcoin Layer. I'm Nick Bhatia. Today, we welcome Ian Major. He is the co-founder of Jolts, and he is at the intersection of Lightning Network, stablecoin adoption, and how this contributes to overall Bitcoin adoption and growth of the network. Ian, great to meet you. Thank you for coming on today.
Likewise, Nick. I'm a huge fan of your work, so it's an honor, and I'm excited for our conversation today.
Thanks. So tell me about Jolts.
Yeah, so Jolts, we're building some of the key infrastructural building blocks for stablecoins on Lightning. So this includes wallet technology, swapping technology, basically the sort of basic Lego blocks, if you will, to make all of this a reality. And we're doing that on top of different protocols such as Tapered Assets, which we can get into as part of today.
So tell me a little bit about your view on the growth of stablecoins and why this actually matters for Bitcoin. Because Bitcoin investment, which centers around owning this scarce digital asset, this neutral asset in an increasingly multipolar world, stablecoins are part of the dollar world. So why does it matter? We can go all the way up until the current Genius Act and the administration's plans on stablecoins. But why does it matter specifically for Bitcoin? Not just why is the stablecoin environment good for the dollar?
Yeah. I even think going backwards the other way is instructive, right? Because a lot of the problems that stablecoins arose to solve look and feel very similar to the problems that we think of Bitcoin as solving. So I don't want to belabor with a lengthy history lesson, but Tether was the first stablecoin. This came out in 2014, when at the time you had, one, the 2013 cycle. This was really the first time that you had pretty broad visibility. Like, people were, for the first time, sort of aware of this thing. And simultaneously, you then had in early 2014, the collapse of Mt. Gox. So all of this created a lot of visibility, and suddenly you had banks debanking, at the time, Bitcoin exchanges, a lot of the big Chinese exchanges in particular, Hong Kong. And so, that sounds sort of like Operation Choke Point 0.1, right? So stablecoins arose out of this debanking that was happening at the time, right? This idea of like, oh, well, if I could have a digital dollar, that would make it a lot easier. I can just sort of circumvent the traditional banking system, which is, of course, far from permissionless. You also, interestingly, shortly thereafter, had a surprise devaluation of the Chinese yuan. This was in 2015. And so now all of a sudden, everyone in China is clamoring for anything they can get their hands on, dollar denominated, Bitcoin, anything, right? And that has been the sort of kernel that we've seen unfold across more and more markets since then, whether it's Argentina, Turkey, Lebanon, Nigeria. All these different jurisdictions are experiencing similar pain points, right? How do I protect my savings from currency debasement? And we think of the dollar as being debased, and it is, but of course, many, many other fiat currencies are debasing even faster. So stablecoins, really, the reason that they've grown so inexorably, and we can get into some of those numbers if it's interesting, and this is not just a bunch of crypto trading stuff anymore. These are real payment flows. The reason for that is an escape from local currency debasement and or an escape from debanking. And so very, very similar pain points and problems. And as stablecoins grow, you see, and is the causality one way or the other, right? Is it like, oh, Bitcoin adoption grows and therefore stablecoin adoption grows, or does stablecoin supply grow and then some of that goes into Bitcoin? I think it's a little bit of both, but suffice it to say that as each of these things grow, it sort of feeds on the other. And in our work at Jolts, we're doing some really sort of direct, we're seeing that in a very direct way. One of our communities in Brazil is using a stablecoin to directly onboard to Bitcoin without having to go through a centralized exchange and all this sort of stuff. So we can get into that example a little bit more. But this very much plays into Bitcoin adoption, even if you have, as a Bitcoiner, no interest whatsoever, in stablecoins themselves.
It's a great answer, because instead of focusing on today, we should start with Tether. It's very important. In my class, I teach my students that Tether and therefore stablecoins are a function or a manifestation of the demand to buy Bitcoin in a digital environment. Otherwise, they wouldn't exist. Would, I think that's a little bit what you're saying, but would you agree with that statement, or is it more this debanking angle that you just referred to? Or are they one and the same?
I think it's both. I think it's both. I do think there is, I do think there are a lot of people out there who are obviously aware of Bitcoin, given that they're using something like USDT, but whose singular goal and focus is USDT to protect them from what is an even worse sort of currency debasement in their local currency, you know, let's say the Argentine peso, what have you. So I do think there is a segment out there for whom Bitcoin is not even like yet on their, maybe they don't have a surplus of savings, right? Like their working capital is something that they can't, you know, hey, I can't afford to like put a lot of this into Bitcoin. If it, you know, dips by 10% or 20%, like that's a huge deal to me personally in my personal finances. But that being said, there's definitely a huge, huge segment for which that's exactly true. And I think that's exactly what we see in the data.
Our research definitely shows how much more popular Tether is in Nigeria versus Bitcoin. So in that, yep, in that one-to-one comparison there, in that one country, we definitely see that. I wanted to ask you about just Tether for one second. If you can wrap up the history lesson, you mentioned the Chinese currency devaluation of 2015. I've written about how Tether, a large part of the early usage of Tether is explicitly Chinese money laundry. So do you have any specific data points or anecdotes that you can share with the viewers so that they can understand Tether's origins? And, you know, that it's just like the Silk Road for Bitcoin. It doesn't mean that Bitcoin today is purposed for buying drugs on the internet, just as Tether today is not purposed for Chinese money laundry, but there are origins in each of those. So I was wondering if you could share any anecdotes there.
Yeah, I mean, for those listening who know of Arthur Hayes, he's written a lot about this, and he was there in Hong Kong sort of at the time, kind of watching this and going to local banks, and he was trying to arbitrage trade across different exchanges. So he's written a lot about this recently. Hard for me to kind of put a percentage of what percent of that early activity was, you know, sort of, you know, illicit money laundering versus, you know, crypto trading versus something else entirely. What I do know is that the CEO of Tether at the time, when they first started and launched, knew a great deal about China. You know, he had been he had run a manufacturing firm. He knew how difficult it was to sort of get dollars into and out of the country. So I think they really saw an opportunity to get that foothold in that market. And as these crypto natives and Bitcoin natives in, you know, China realize what this thing was, then, you know, inevitably you see other uses, you know, both sort of good and bad, but not a whole lot personally, but beyond that.
Now, I want to get into the data of stablecoin growth first, yeah, before we get into Lightning Network and why Lightning really matters here. And the viewers should understand here that we're doing this episode today not to cover stablecoins by themselves, but Lightning's impact on stablecoin usage and the mechanics of that. So let's first talk about the data that you have around stablecoin growth itself.
Absolutely. And yeah, and I would even throw it out there that if I could wave a magic wand and tomorrow we're all on a Bitcoin standard, I would do that. You know, that is unfortunately not the world we live in. I think there's over $300 trillion in dollar-denominated debt globally. And that, for better or worse, reinforces this sort of network effect of these fiat units of account. So our thesis at Jolts is that, look, the dollar as a unit of account is going to be around for a very, very, very long time. We can do one of two things about that. We can kind of throw our hands up and continue pushing on this sort of, you know, Bitcoin Track, which, right, like, is going very well, I would say. But in terms of crossing this next phase of Bitcoin, not merely as a store of value, but actually as a medium of exchange as well, I think stablecoins and Lightning plays a crucial part in that bridge. And so to, you know, share some statistics with you, and I think what's even more interesting than the statistics themselves, the sort of water levels of where they currently stand, is the change relative to when I was first pulling some of this earlier this year. So right now, over the last 30 days, if you then annualize that, we're currently looking at about 11 trillion in stablecoin payment volume. There's two data sources I often reference, Allium Labs, as well as and Artemis, right? These are two just sort of stablecoin analytic companies. They both produce what is called an adjusted volume metric. And this is really key because people will often throw around a 30, 35 trillion number. And that includes a lot of the sort of cross exchange volume, right? If I'm Coinbase and I'm settling value with Binance, it's a heck of a lot easier to do that in a stablecoin than it is to do through banking rails. So strip all that away. There's all this sort of MEV kind of crazy stuff that, you know, happens in Ethereum land and other ecosystems. Like, strip all of that away, strip all of this sort of inorganic activity away. It's still not a, you know, 100% perfect measure, but it gets to a pretty good measure of real, genuine, organic payment activity. So 11 trillion annualized over the last 12 months. For context, Visa did 16 trillion in 2024. MasterCard did 10 trillion. So, like, order of magnitude, stablecoins are already sort of on par with these incumbent giants. And this is across a whole bevy of use cases. We see a lot of B2B payments now. So Latin American businesses paying their Asian suppliers, for example. You see an increasing amount of B2C payments. I think it was Bolivia. This was not too long ago, where there were some pictures flying around of stores, merchants in Bolivia, pricing their goods in USDT, right? You know, they're not even, obviously one USDT is, you know, one USD, but, you know, it's getting really, really interesting that USDT is almost a de facto day-to-day currency in some of these markets. Obviously, in jurisdictions where individuals have a really hard time getting access to dollar-denominated value, you know, that is in and of itself a use case, a little bit more on the store of value side. But 11 trillion annualized, and that is double what it was when I gave a talk earlier this year, end of January, at the Plan B Forum in El Salvador. So, call it 6 months' time, things are growing very, very rapidly.
And I would strongly agree with that statement. Recently, I made the claim that I believe Tether is now a global reserve asset / global reserve currency.
Yep.
It is being used in that way and crossing above the 100 billion market cap in Tether outstanding really just shows you that that number is probably heading to a trillion at some point. I don't actually have the time that it took for Tether to increase its recent order of magnitude, but maybe we'll pull that information after. Over 10,000 investors downloaded the original How to Position for the Bitcoin Boom report when Bitcoin was 27K and it called for 120. The target is hit. What's next? Tour de Meester is back with the 2025 edition, refreshed for the mid-cycle moment. New data, new insights, and get Tour's latest price expectation. Plus, you'll get exclusive access to charting our way through chaos. Tour's new 30-minute Q3 2025 presentation. He explains why this bull run might just be beginning. Read the first ever mid-cycle report from Adamant Research at unchained.com/TBL. Blockstream, where the future of finance runs on Bitcoin. Go to store.blockstream.com and use code TBL for 10% off. Pick up a Jade Plus hardware wallet. It integrates seamlessly with your Blockstream app, and it's the perfect way for both pros and beginners of Bitcoin to get started with your cold storage. Store.blockstream.com, use code TBL for 10% off. Let's talk about Lightning Network now. Lightning Network is something that we've researched at the Bitcoin layer since the beginning. I've been writing about it since 2018. It seemed to me in the early days that Lightning Network was essential to scale Bitcoin. Now we're talking about Lightning Network being the rails for stablecoins. So break it down, explain to someone that might not understand Lightning Network even at all.
What is
Lightning in a couple sentences if you can, and then why does it matter for stablecoins?
Yeah, definitely. So the Lightning Network, for those not familiar, is a sort of layer two on top of Bitcoin based on this concept of payment channels. So for example, Nick, you and I can create a payment channel between ourselves. And this is just a normal two of two multi-sig transaction. So it's an on-chain Bitcoin transaction that initiates this payment channel. And now once that's established, you and I can send payments back and forth between ourselves as many times as we want for free. And each of those transfers does not necessarily have to settle down to the Bitcoin chain. So you're alleviating and moving some of this transactional activity that would otherwise need to settle on the sort of layer one, Bitcoin. You're moving that off chain. Now, if that was it, that would not be totally, useful. But if I have, someone else that I need to send value to, and I don't have a channel directly with that individual or business, but you do, I can actually route my payment through you to that business. So the Lightning Network, think of it as a sea of these two of two payment channels. And that architecture is really, really unique. When Lightning first came out, sort of expectations were so high. It's like, this is going to immediately scale Bitcoin and it's the silver bullet. And, it turns out, the infrastructure, the UX takes time to, mature and all those different things. But that payment channel based architecture is unique and gets us into why it's such a useful scaling technology for, I'll say, payments in general, and certainly, stablecoin payments. Paolo Arduino, the CEO of Tether, even said it in his own words. You look at some of what's happening in these other crypto ecosystems. So Ethereum L2s, Solana, Tron, who, some listening may not even really be that aware of Tron. Tron is actually the number one blockchain when it comes to stablecoin activity in terms of number of transactions and overall volume, not necessarily supply. I think Ethereum still has Tron beat there. But you have this bevy of supply and activity happening elsewhere, but you can already start to see the signs of strain. For example, Tron's transaction fees, if you look at just their average transaction fee over the last couple of years even, is up about 10x. And it's up so much so that, Tron leadership, Justin Sun and team, are sort of, how do we solve this? How do we, bring fees down, et cetera? Ethereum L2s, there was an interesting piece earlier this year from a builder within that space that sort of cited, this blob space on Ethereum and how these L2s sort of utilize that space. They're also kind of running into some headwinds. And the idea of scaling stablecoin transactions, if you look at it just on a number of transactions basis versus number of total economic transactions in the, in the economy, I mean, we have to increase by at least 10,000x from here. So it is simply the case that this long known maxim in the industry that blockchains don't scale, I think is very apt and is exactly kind of what we're starting to see. And, Solana says, well, we've got our, upcoming Fire Dancer client that's going to, but then there's delays there. So all of these ecosystems are facing challenges is basically my point. And meanwhile, Lightning takes a fundamentally different approach to scaling. And the singular concept that's important for people to realize is that Lightning does not have what's called a global state, right? I don't need to care about or validate every single thing that's happening on this network. I just have what I care about. I have this payment that I want to get done. And that is a huge, huge unlock. So it is my belief, at least, that if we are to see global stablecoin, you know, usage at a truly global level, and I think that's where this train is heading. It is my belief that something like Lightning is actually the only technology capable of scaling payments in that fashion.
Lightning Network, the only technology capable of scaling the demand in the future for stablecoins. I find that fascinating. So let's give, because I want this to be a 101 episode for people, explain to people Tether, USDT. It's an ERC-20 token. What does that mean? What is, you know, as the Bitcoin layer, we're thinking about Bitcoin. Is there any value for this other network because Tether is using it? I know that Tether is now starting to hop on to Lightning, but how does that even work? How do people understand that? What's an ERC-20 token? Can you walk us through some of those basics so that people can understand that the Ethereum, using Ethereum as a network itself, might be changing in the future because of Lightning?
Yeah, exactly. So for folks to understand, you know, stablecoin issuers choose which chains they want to issue their stablecoin on. And so, as you pointed out, the ERC-20 standard is the sort of token standard on Ethereum that governs how tokens on Ethereum work, what is the sort of metadata that should be populated for these different tokens, et cetera. There's a similar concept for Tron and Solana and sort of all these chains that Tether issues on. As you're alluding to, earlier this year, Tether made an exciting announcement that USDT would be issued natively on Bitcoin. And what's interesting, going back to the history lesson, is that that is actually where Tether started. Tether started from the very outset on something called the Omni layer, or the Omni protocol of Bitcoin. And this was sort of the OG meta protocol. You know, for viewers and listeners that have heard the word meta protocol thrown around over these last couple of years with ordinals and runes and these different things, the Omni layer was really the sort of OG of that. And so how these meta protocols work for Bitcoin. So basically you have this asset that gets issued on these other chains. How it works in Bitcoin land is you want some information about these assets that's being actually encoded onto the Bitcoin blockchain, you know, via a transaction of some kind. And so you now actually have a couple different ways that you can do that. The protocol that we are sort of most, you know, kind of familiar with and actively building on at Jolts is something called Taproot Assets. So this was developed by Lightning Labs over the last couple of years. For those not familiar, Lightning Labs is behind the L&D implementation of the Lightning Network. So you've got the Lightning Network itself, you've got a couple different implementations. L&D is by far the biggest. And then now you have this asset protocol, Taproot Assets, that allows an issuer like Tether to mint and create this stablecoin. And not only have that natively on Bitcoin, but also you can deposit it and move it along the Lightning Network. So now all of a sudden you're sort of combining the utility of, you know, having familiar units of account to kind of meet people where they are. Again, if I could wave that magic wand and have everyone on a Bitcoin standard, I would, but that's not where most people are today. And you combine that with the scalability, speed, low cost of Lightning. So it's a really exciting thing. So we got the announcement earlier this year. We still have not had the actual issuance just yet, but I think we will see that here very shortly.
Okay, now tell people where your company comes in as we stand in the middle of ERC-20 Tether and Taproot, potentially Taproot Asset Tether. And if you want to, you can explain a little bit more about the Taproot upgrade to Bitcoin and why that matters, or you can skip right to where your company is getting involved here.
Yeah. I think both of those things are helpful. So for folks aware, we had the Taproot upgrade to Bitcoin in 2021. And among other things, what that brought us was this new construct called a Taproot script tree. Without going into all the detail, essentially what this allows us to do is encode new types of spending conditions to enable more sort of flexible use cases of Bitcoin transactions. And so what's particularly elegant about Taproot Assets is unlike the Omni protocol way back in the day, and even unlike Ordinals and Runes, where you have a lot of data that's like being added to the chain, you only have this small sort of hash of information being written into this Taproot script tree in the case of Taproot Assets. And all the other sort of metadata and proof data that I need to understand the lineage of these different assets is stored completely off-chain. So it's very good from a chain efficiency standpoint. And it's also very good from a privacy standpoint because these Taproot asset transactions look just the same on the blockchain as a normal Taproot transaction. So it's good for privacy. It's good for sort of chain efficiency. And that was kind of the big breakthrough that the Taproot upgrade brought that has now enabled something like Taproot assets, to occur. Where we Jolt play in is, you know, if you think of the scaffolding as these different levels of the tech stack, you have protocols at the base level. So that's Bitcoin, Lightning, Taproot assets. These are all the sort of protocols. Jolt sort of sits one level up. So we're trying to build the infrastructure that makes those protocols actually usable and easy to use because building on Bitcoin is difficult, right? You know, building on Lightning is difficult. Building on Taproot assets is difficult. You need developer tooling like SDKs, software development kits and APIs and these different things that make it easier for wallets to adopt this, for example, that make it easier for different payment platforms to adopt this, for example. So that's the sort of infrastructural layer that we're building. And I think part of what you're also getting at, Nick, in your earlier question is, well, what about like, how do I enable some of this liquidity that exists in other chains and allow that to flow into Bitcoin via something like a bridge, right? And that, so that's another piece of infrastructure that we're getting started on currently, which is a way for individuals. Let's say that you have USDT on Ethereum or Polygon or Solana or whatever other kind of alternative ecosystem. How do you make it easy for people to bridge that over and experience the benefits of Lightning? That's another kind of critical piece of the puzzle in all this.
Get into that a little bit more. What are you building there, and how is that going to work if somebody brings Tether over to the Taproot asset protocol? Tether, does it destroy the ERC-20 token? Can you walk us through how Bitcoin might pull that activity and the market cap, because that's really what matters, is the capital itself.
Yeah, and that really is one of my key points in all of this around adoption, is right now you have millions and millions of individuals and businesses around the world that are going to these other chains simply because their primary initial use case is around stablecoins. And they just don't have, like, in particularly in LATAM, where I think there's particularly high affinity towards Bitcoin, and they would love to have Tether on Lightning, but they begrudgingly have to go to, Ethereum and Tron and, some of these sort of worse trust assumptions. So you already have a nascent kind of body of demand that would love to do this on day one with sort of no further education or incentive or what have you. The other kind of piece to think about, as you pointed out, is the capital piece of this. Right now, order of magnitude, you have probably, let's call it 10 billion maybe annually dollars worth of payment volume on the Lightning Network. If Bitcoin were to capture its quote unquote fair share of that 11 trillion number that I mentioned earlier, based on its roughly 59% market dominance currently, that's like 1,000x plus increase in potential payment volume and potentially capital on the Lightning Network. What does that do? That makes all the business models of all these different Lightning companies building this important infrastructure to harden and mature Lightning, it makes that way more sustainable. So I don't think there's anything else remotely close that could increase the amount of payment activity on Lightning. The other really cool property of something like Taproot assets in particular is it leverages pre-existing Bitcoin liquidity on Lightning. What I mean by that is, let's say I have USDT on Lightning and I want to send that to someone else. And let's say that it's a couple hops between myself and that other individual that I want to send it to. What actually happens at the protocol level is when I send that, that USDT is actually getting converted into Bitcoin and is then flying across the rest of the Lightning network in Bitcoin. And right before it gets to that recipient, it converts back into, in this case, USDT. And so for those listening that are familiar with Strike, you know, very successful Bitcoin business, that's like sort of what they do, right? Is they kind of utilize the Lightning network as this sort of payment rail. And then they have these sort of fiat conversions on either end. This is basically doing all of that natively on Lightning, which I think is very cool. And it opens up all sorts of different payment experiences. You know, if you need to send dollars and that other person needs to receive euros. Let's say you're a Bitcoiner, Nick, and you don't care at all about holding your value in USDT. I can pay you in USDT and you can receive it in Bitcoin. Or let's say a merchant who's like, look, Bitcoin's awesome, but like I have to pay my employees, I have to pay my costs in dollars. You, Nick, can pay in Bitcoin and I, the merchant, can receive in dollars. So it unlocks all these interchangeable payment use cases. And it also further seeds this Lightning network flywheel. And as that activity comes from Tron, from Solana, from Ethereum, you're having more and more people who otherwise would just simply not be on the Bitcoin network that are now on the Bitcoin network. And guess what? You know, Jolt makes it really easy for you to swap between whatever, you know, stablecoin asset you have in Bitcoin. You can do that in a self-custodial fashion. So now you're one gigantic step closer to the ultimate thing, the ultimate life raft that is Bitcoin, right? We could get into as well a whole nother dimension, which you have written about. I've cited your work in some of my pieces around this idea of Bitcoin native yield, which the Lightning Network provides for. Assets on Lightning opens up yet new opportunities for that, as well as this sort of incentive to pull liquidity and capital from these other ecosystems to Bitcoin. So it's a really, really interesting set of dynamics we're starting to see.
That might be a good second follow-up episode. We can definitely just talk about yield itself. Yes. That would be pretty exciting. Now, I want to ask you about the... You mentioned two things in this episode so far that might seem contradictory, but can, and I believe do exist at the same time and will persist. Number one, we have $300 trillion in dollar denominated debt, which you said reinforces the network effect for the dollar. It's because the debt itself has to be paid back and has a life cycle and likely gets rolled. So you're locked into a dollar-denominated debt world. I strongly agree with that. As you know, it's part of my thesis in Bitcoin Age, my new book, that the dollar system and Bitcoin will coexist because the dollar system is a credit system. So that's that $300 trillion that you refer to. But you're also now talking about a world in which Taproot assets, Lightning Network, and Tether can build out an entire Forex system for the world and transactional system for the world that works better than current dollar infrastructure. So why do these two things coexist to you, Ian?
Yeah, well, we could do a third episode on all the Genius Act stuff that's sort of unfolding. It's like, why is the U.S. government pushing seemingly suddenly so hard in this direction of stablecoins? And I think at this point, the cat is out of the bag. It's no longer a secret that Tether and these major issuers are some of the biggest holders of, you know, treasury debt. And so for better or worse, at least the powers that be are looking at this stablecoin thing as a way to finance the U.S. government, and in fact, potentially even extend the longevity and hegemony of the dollar, which, again, as a Bitcoiner, I have conflicted opinions on. I prefer to sort of, you know, look at the data as it is and not as I wish it could be. But I think you're going to see the combination of stablecoins and Bitcoin, in a nutshell, I think offers this incredibly elegant solution to the U.S. government. You have more balance sheet capacity to finance your debt. And you also are simultaneously identifying this asset where, as a release valve, like you need to get the dollar lower to reshore manufacturing capacity and all this sort of reindustrialization stuff. And, you know, you need to do that in a way in which you're weakening the dollar, but you're not like totally giving up the dollar's role as at least a, you know, one of these sort of dominant kind of reserve currencies. So how do you thread that needle? I think stablecoins provide, again, for better or worse, a really elegant solution to that. And so that's why you're seeing this huge push. And, you know, so I think that's going to feed on itself. Like, what is the logical conclusion of that? I don't really know. I don't yet know. But I think you're going to see shorter and shorter duration debt. You're going to see, you know, higher and higher percentage of T-bills getting issued by the U.S. government. Their hope is that, you know, stablecoin demand can continue to sort of suck that up. And they basically financially repress bondholders and, you know, sort of reset things. I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see. But I think that's kind of the linkage between these two things. And as I was saying earlier, like the macro and micro, when they align, it's a really powerful thing. And so, again, if you're listening to this and you could care less about stablecoins, in some ways, stablecoins care about you, right? And it impacts, you know, Bitcoin and Bitcoin adoption. We are bullish in seeing communities like Brazil, where we're working very closely with, using stablecoins as a direct route to onboard to Bitcoin to get to that ultimate life raft. How the rest of this sort of more political lens of it plays out, I think remains to be seen.
I didn't know, for the record, that we would be getting into the T-bill percentage of Treasury debt outstanding, but it is such an important point for TBL pros. You guys understand that it's a big part of TBL liquidity is the size of the T-bill stock. And if the U.S. government is hell-bent on increasing the quantity of T-bills out there in the market to really reduce the amount of debt it has to issue long-term, which negatively impacts liquidity, it would increase bond volatility. It could likely steepen the curve and increase interest rates. It also is a duration hit on the market, meaning that when the market buys long-term treasuries, they absorb duration risk. That's the risk that interest rates rise. And when they absorb that risk and buy long-term bonds, it makes them less likely to own other risk assets because they are introducing duration risk into their portfolio. So for all these reasons, the quantity of T-bills relative to the quantity of treasury debt in outstanding matters a lot. So I just wanted to throw that in there for people so that they understand how intertwined some of these issues are. Absolutely. You mentioned, do Bitcoiners even want this?
Yeah.
Stablecoin thing. So I want to ask you about that. Let's do that last. Before we do that, talk to me about the Lightning Network capacity statistics and the number of nodes. Is that a number you watch? Does it matter? Is it a good number? I'm really curious about overall LN capacity. Does it matter more in dollars or BTC? What are the Lightning Network statistics that you look at to judge the growth and health of this network?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And, you know, you've seen some of these statistics, like, for example, you've seen capacity over the last, call it, year or two come down a little bit. And people, you know, point at that and they say, oh, see, you know, I told you so. Lightning is dead. It's not going to work. When in reality, what's happening is just a lot more capital efficiency with the use of channels that are remaining. River, for example, came out with, a good report on that. Amboss, of course, has published a number of really helpful kind of statistics. The ones that I look at the most are, and this is the hardest to measure, is just actual payment volume, right? The reason that's hard to measure is you have private channels, which make it very difficult to, with precision, measure the total payment volume on the network. But you've had some great reports. Voltage partnered up with Fidelity recently to do a great report. Breeze has done some good analysis on this. Voltage or Amboss as well. And so that's kind of how I like triangulate to this sort of order of magnitude, 10-ish billion, US dollar kind of number annually. I personally, and again, this pains me a little bit to say, but I do personally still think that looking at capacity on a dollar basis is currently more important than on a Bitcoin basis. As Bitcoin, if you have the same amount of Bitcoin capacity and Bitcoin price, rips by double, you suddenly have, a lot more capacity in dollar terms to facilitate payments. And so in this ensuing period where you have this coexistence, I think that's important. Node count, I look at, but I don't sort of obsess over it. I don't fixate on it too much. One of the other more anecdotal data points that started to come out, we saw this at the Bitcoin 2025 conference recently in Las Vegas, was Block. So, Jack Dorsey's Block, which has Cash App and Lightning functionality sort of all built throughout that. They run a Lightning Network routing node, C equals, and you may have seen the statistic flying around. They shared that they were getting like a 10% yield in Bitcoin by running this kind of Lightning routing node. For listeners, I think that's pretty difficult to replicate. However, it is nonetheless illustrative of what I think is another really, really interesting statistic to try and measure. And Nick, you wrote about this long ago, that Amboss tried to codify in its sort of liner index, right? Like, what is the rate of return that you can achieve by participating in the Lightning Network, by deploying liquidity and Bitcoin capital to the Lightning Network? That is an essential piece of this overall flywheel that I also, pay some close attention to, even though it's hard to measure.
Crazy to think that Lightning Network generated yield is now materially important for the growth of the network. Things have come a long way. So bring it home for us, Ian. Why do we care about this stablecoin growth for Bitcoin? Is it really Lightning Network that we care about, or is it Bitcoin in general? What is your big picture takeaway for people as they go home today?
Yeah, big picture takeaway is I think this is on net good for Bitcoin. That does not mean that there's no risks to this, right? What are the potential downsides or risks of this? Nothing is, a free lunch. People have talked about chain choice, right? What if a big issuer, has a ton of stablecoin supply on a particular chain and that chain forks? The issuer has to pick which of those forks it's going to honor. And that can have undue influence, right? You don't want an entity like that to have sort of undue influence. We could get into that maybe in a future conversation. I think that's a real but manageable risk, particularly what we've seen in the past with, the block size wars, et cetera. People will also throw out, what about freezability? This is, this is not the Bitcoin ethos. It's not censorship resistant. And that is right? I am not out here saying you should use stablecoins. I want everyone to get to Bitcoin. The good thing about these protocols, Taproot Assets, there's Spark now, you have the sort of, the issuer can kind of choose. So I want this to be a freezable asset, or I don't want this to be a freezable asset. And you're seeing some really interesting work from the likes of Alpen Labs as an example, who's working on this Bitcoin dollar, like Bitcoin backed. So that this is my, sweet spot in my heart, a Bitcoin-backed stablecoin that is truly censorship resistant and truly, permissionless. I think that, again, combines the underlying collateral of Bitcoin, which if you're a hodler, like that's a very good thing, again, with the utility of stablecoins. So there are some some risks in all of this. You know, none of this is kind of rainbows and unicorns all the way down. But on net, I think the upside is huge. Millions of people, as I said, are going to other chains and are getting exposed to Bitcoin much later than they could if they're coming straight to Bitcoin. You know, that doesn't count migrating some of this activity and users from other ecosystems as well. So from a number of users go up standpoint, I think this, there are few incremental growth levers as stablecoins on Bitcoin. From a growing the Lightning Network standpoint, which is a crucial scaling tool for Bitcoin, there is nothing remotely close, I think, that can contribute, you know, the benefit that stablecoins has. So in terms of maturing the most important, you know, scaling technology that we have for Bitcoin, this is very important. And again, for us, it just gets people faster on their path to their very first Bitcoin. And it also, I think, by bringing people onto the payment rails of Bitcoin, which is Lightning, it also can accelerate us to this next phase of actually using Bitcoin as a medium of exchange. And that will start with this interoperation between dollars and Bitcoin on the Lightning Network payment rails. But increasingly, you know, you have people sort of on that system. It's a lot easier for them to start using Bitcoin as an actual means of exchange. So I think the upsides outweigh the downsides, but, you know, maybe your listeners can comment here on whether they agree or disagree.
A quick shout out to Miles at Block for his contributions that Ian mentioned here, and the entire team at Lightning Labs, all the developers working on LND and the other products, because it serves as the foundation for things that Ian is working on. Ian Major, thank you for joining us so much today. We are not affiliated with Ian's company in any way. We do these episodes so that we can learn. This is research, and we really appreciate you sharing your insights about your company, and we look forward to more conversations with you. Please tell people where they can find your company and your work.
Absolutely. You can follow me on X. It is Ian_Major. You can also check out our work at Jolts. We are on X at Jolts, J-O-L-T-Z _BTC, or you can find us at jolts.app, which is our website. But Nick, no, it's a thrilling pleasure. Thank you for having me on, and I'll hope to do this again sometime soon.
Thanks, Ian. We'll catch you guys next time.
Cheers.